Welcome to Washington Today for Monday, September 23rd, 2024. I'm Gary Sterkoff. Thank you for joining us today. House Republican leaders unveiled their Plan B over the weekend to keep the government open past September 30th, a continuing resolution that contains additional funding for the Secret Service but doesn't include the SAVE Act. That's the Republican proposal requiring proof of citizenship to register to vote. The bill is expected to be on the House floor by midweek. We'll hear what Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer thinks about it coming up. President Biden says the White House is working to de-escalate the growing conflict in the Middle East between Israel and Iranian-backed terrorists in Hezbollah. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is asking the people of Lebanon to, quote, get out of harm's way while Israel targets Hezbollah positions. The man who police say tried to kill former President Trump on his golf course appeared in federal court in West Palm Beach, Florida today. The federal judge at the hearing denied bail to Ryan Wesley Routh, calling him a serious flight risk and a danger to the community. Federal prosecutors also revealed that Mr. Routh spent at least a month in Florida planning the attack and left a note with a friend saying, quote, this was an assassination attempt. We begin on Capitol Hill and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on the new plan to keep the government open past next Monday.
Madam President, yesterday afternoon, we announced that congressional leaders reached a bipartisan agreement to avoid a government shutdown on September the 30th. This agreement will keep the government open at current funding levels until December 20th. This agreement, thankfully, is free of any partisan poison pills and was negotiated in good faith. I thank the Speaker for working with my team to put this package together over the weekend. Our teams were up early and stayed late into the evening to get it done. I also wish to thank the House Democratic leader, the Senate Republican leader, and all the appropriators, particularly Senators Murray and Collins, for helping us get to this point. The matter is now straightforward. We now have less than a week to pass a funding bill through the House, through the Senate, and on to the President's desk. Both sides will have to act celeritously and with continued bipartisan good faith to meet the funding deadline. Any delay or last-minute poison pill can still push us into a shutdown. I hope and I trust that this will not happen. Of course, as we proceed, it's important to remember that negotiations didn't have to wait until the last minute. This agreement could have very easily been reached weeks ago, but Speaker Johnson and House Republicans chose to listen to Donald Trump's partisan demands instead of working with us from the start to reach a bicameral, bipartisan agreement. Remember, Donald Trump has spent the entire month urging House Republicans to shut the government down if his poison pills weren't passed. That is outlandishly cynical. Donald Trump knows perfectly well that a shutdown would mean chaos, pain, needless heartache for the American people, but, as usual, he just doesn't seem to care. It's astounding that anyone seeking the presidency would think a shutdown is a good thing. But that's who Donald Trump is at his core. Cynical and ill-intentioned. He should have learned his lesson years ago when he told Speaker Pelosi and I to shut down the government and said, I'll take the blame. Well, that didn't work out too well for him, did it? I'm glad his efforts in this instance are on track to fail. We aren't out of the woods yet, but now that we've reached a bipartisan agreement, I hope we're on track to avoid a shutdown. I believe we will avoid that shutdown. With a few more days of bipartisanship and speed and good faith, we can get the job done, certainly before the deadline of a government shutdown.
Now, House Speaker Mike Johnson released a Dear Colleague letter announcing the deal yesterday. It reads in part, quote, as you all know, we presented a plan last week for a six-month CR accompanied by the SAVE Act so that we could both meet our funding obligations and do all within our power to ensure election security. Due to the urgency of that issue, the American people deserve nothing less. His letter goes on to say, quote, since we fell a bit short of the goal line, an alternative plan is now required. The feedback and ideas from everyone have been very helpful, and next week the House will take the initiative and pass a clean three-month CR to prevent the Senate from jamming us with a bill loaded with billions in new spending and unrelated provisions. Our legislation will be a very narrow, bare-bones CR, including only the extensions that are absolutely necessary. While this is not the solution any of us prefer, it is the most prudent path forward under the present circumstances. As history has taught and current polling affirms, shutting the government down less than 40 days from a fateful election would be an act of political malpractice. That's part of a Dear Colleague letter from House Speaker Mike Johnson he released yesterday. With more on all of this, here's NBC News senior congressional reporter Scott Wong.
Well, we're in a much better place than we were last week. Bipartisan negotiators worked through the end of last week, through the weekend, have come up with a place that we sort of knew we were going to end up at, which is a bipartisan government funding deal, a three-month CR or continuing resolution that basically extends funding to December 20th. It's relatively clean. There's not many poison pills or significant policy provisions attached. It basically averts a shutdown before the election. Now, the House does have to pass it this week. We expect that's going to happen on by Wednesday, sometime in the middle of the week. Then it goes to the Senate. Senator Schumer says he likes what he sees. The White House says is urging passage as well. And so Schumer says they could be out of here with the government funded by the end of this week if there is bipartisan cooperation on both sides.
If there is bipartisan cooperation in the past, especially when it comes to the House and Speaker Johnson, there have been members of his party concerned that he requires Democratic votes to pass a bill, that he needs Democrats to move legislation in the House. Is that happening this time? Is he getting that kind of pushback for coming up with a bill that requires Democrats because he's going to lose some Republicans here?
He is getting some pushback. There's a large faction of conservatives that already say they won't support the CR. But we sort of knew that we were going to be in this position weeks ago, that it would require House Democrats working in conjunction with House Republicans in order to move this across the finish line. Byron Donalds, you know, one of the conservatives from the House Freedom Caucus, told us last week he will be voting no. He said that he had favored the earlier approach, which was a six-month CR, including the SAVE Act, that is that Donald Trump-backed provision that would require proof of citizenship in order for people to register to vote. The reason why the conservatives wanted this funding fight pushed to the new year was because they believe that President Trump would be elected and he would be in a much better negotiating position on funding and spending issues than if, you know, this gets punted to the lame duck session right before the holidays, where Republicans expect Democrats will try to load this up with a lot of different goodies and provisions that will not be to the liking of conservatives.
And here we are looking at a December 20th, right before the holidays.
Yep.
Timeline for this. Voting bill, the SAVE Act, not included. But what is included is more funding for Secret Service. Explain how much money, and is that something that is going to make it through this week to the final version of the bill?
It looks like it will. It's a significant addition to this CR. $231 million in additional funding that the Secret Service will be able to spend over these next few months as we see these, apparent assassination attempts on Donald Trump, now multiple of them, correct? And so this was something that President Biden had asked for, something that the Secret Service had been asking for, more resources, and a number of lawmakers on Capitol Hill saying we have to do something to give the Secret Service as much support as they need heading into this critical final weeks of the campaign.
Okay, say this passes the House with Democratic support. Is there a way, because we know things work differently in the Senate, is there a way a Republican senator who has objections with this bill to hold up this bill past September 30th and that government shutdown deadline?
Yeah, it's mainly a timing issue, how quickly the House can send that over to the Senate. If it's by Wednesday, they're in really good shape to get this done before the September 30th deadline when funding runs out. If it drifts into later in the week, Friday, or even later, then we start to run into some problems because As we know, any one senator can delay the process. This is why Senator Schumer is asking for bipartisan cooperation on both sides, because any one senator can slow down this process, throw roadblocks in the way, and try to drag this out and make it as painful as possible for the other side.
What is Mitch McConnell telling Republicans in the Senate?
Mitch McConnell has been insistent from day one that a shutdown would be politically catastrophic for his party just 40-some-odd days before the election. That is a similar message, interestingly enough, even though Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, is a fiscal conservative, at one point had been a member of sort of these hard-right factions, has been echoing the McConnell line, saying that it would be political malpractice for Republicans to shut the government down in advance of the election. The reason being is that the polls show that Republicans certainly would get the blame heading into the elections. That would hurt a lot of the swing district and swing state candidates that are going to be on the ballot this November in very critical races. And the balance of power is at stake in both chambers of Congress, both in the House and the Senate, where the majority parties have just a razor-thin edge in terms of holding control of those chambers.
NBC News senior congressional reporter Scott Wong on C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Today in the House, members are working on several bills, including a measure to reauthorize funding for NASA for the upcoming year and another bill to increase safety protocols on dating apps. Also today, New Jersey Democratic Representative-elect LaMonica McIver will be sworn in to replace Democratic Congressman Donald Payne Jr., who died in April. Over in the Senate, they've been working on the nomination of Rose Jenkins to be a judge on the U.S. Tax Court for a 15-year term. A confirmation vote is scheduled for 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Looking ahead this week, the bipartisan task force investigating the assassination attempts on former President Trump is holding its first hearing. That's on Thursday. And tomorrow, a statue of singer and songwriter Johnny Cash will be unveiled in the House of Representatives. Of course, the House is always live when it is in session on C-SPAN, the Senate on C-SPAN 2, and get all of our congressional coverage at cspan.org and on our free mobile video app, C-SPAN Now. President Biden welcomed the President of the United Arab Emirates, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, to the White House today. His appearance comes as Israel continues its assault on Hezbollah targets in Lebanon.
Well, Sheikh Mohammed, welcome back to Washington.
Thank you, sir.
You've been a good friend. Our countries have a strategic partnership rooted in decades of close cooperation and friendship, and I welcome the chance to open a new chapter here. UAE is a nation of trailblazers, always looking to the future, always making big bets. And there's something our countries have in common and our people have in common. In fact, it's a cornerstone of our growing cooperation in AI and clean energy and space and investing in infrastructure to connect regions. And for many years, our forces also stood shoulder to shoulder in the same most difficult places. Today, we honor that legacy and carry our initiative forward as UAE is going to become a major defense partner of the United States, joining one other country, India. We also will discuss our efforts to end the war in Gaza and a number of regional issues. I've been briefed on the latest developments in Israel and Lebanon. My team is in constant contact with their counterparts, and we're working to de-escalate in a way that allows people to return to their homes safely. Mr. President, I want you to know that I remain committed to the UAE's security, and I look forward to discussions going to cover a lot of areas. So again, welcome.
Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell also talked about the situation.
Consider Lebanon itself. Hezbollah is a cancer on the Lebanese state. It wields its power as a sectarian terror squad and leaves a long trail of blood through its highest ranks of civilian government and civil society. Sunnis, Christians, Druze, and fellow Shiites, none are immune from Hezbollah's wrath. Then again, National Public Radio refers to Hezbollah as a, quote, political, end quote, group. Perhaps the administration's officials' confusion is a symbol of their media diet. or more likely, the foundations of their foreign policy are fundamentally flawed. Remember the declaration by the president's national security advisor early last fall that the Middle East was, quote, quieter than it had been in decades, end quote. The absurdity of that boast in light of October 7th is striking enough. But even when it was written, it betrayed the administration's naivete toward glaring and abiding threats to Israel and America's national security interests in the region. Iran's agents in Syria and Iraq had already fired hundreds of rockets at American forces on this administration's watch. Since last October, these attacks have only metastasized, including into the Red Sea. So was this an acceptable status quo? Was Hezbollah's steady preparation for war? Was Hamas' expropriation of humanitarian assistance in order to build terror tunnels? The United States ought to stand with our friend Israel as it faces these terrorists down. The goal should not be simply to avoid escalation or to return to the status quo ante, but to help Israel defend itself against terrorists bent on Israel's destruction.
Earlier today, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that his country's military is changing, quote, balance of power in the north. He also had this message.
I have a message for the people of Lebanon. Israel's war is not with you. It's with Hezbollah. For too long, Hezbollah has been using you as human shields. It placed rockets in your living rooms and missiles in your garage. Those rockets and missiles are aimed directly at our cities, directly at our citizens. To defend our people against Hezbollah strikes, we must take out those weapons. Now, starting this morning, the IDF has warned you to get out of harm's way. I urge you, take this warning seriously. Don't let Hezbollah endanger your lives and the lives of your loved ones. Don't let Hezbollah endanger Lebanon. Please, get out of harm's way now. Once our operation is finished, you can come back safely to your homes.
According to CNN, more than 350 people have been killed and 1,200 others injured in Israeli airstrikes in Lebanon on Monday. That marks the deadliest day of battle between Israel and the Iranian-backed terrorist group since the 2006 war. CNN.com also reporting Hezbollah's second-in-command saying, quote, a battle without limits was underway as the terrorist group launched more strikes inside Israel. You're listening to Washington Today.
Gearing up for the vice presidential debate, Tim Walz versus J.D. Vance? Then you might want to remember the first time running mates debated in a formal, nationally televised setting.
Good evening. I'm James Hogue, editor of the Chicago Sun-Times and moderator of this third of the historic debates of the 1976 campaign. Tonight we have the vice presidential candidates. For the Democrats, Senator Walter Mondale of Minnesota. For the Republicans, Senator Robert Dole of Kansas. Thank you, Senator Mondale, and thank you, Senator Dole, for being with us this evening. This debate is taking place before an audience in the Alley Theater in Houston, Texas. It is also being broadcast by radio and television to an audience estimated at some 85 million persons in this nation and overseas.
That's how the debate opened on October 15, 1976. Walter Mondale versus Bob Dole. On October 1, 2024, it will be Tim Walz versus J.D. Vance. And the 12th time running mates have debated over nearly half a century. What were the top, most famous, most newsmaking, most notable, funniest, legendary, and otherwise best of moments, phrases, and zingers from the first 11 vice presidential debates? Find out in the latest episode of C-SPAN's Podcast The Weekly. Find C-SPAN's The Weekly wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to Washington Today. Reaction is still coming in on Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell's announcement last week of the central bank's biggest rate cut since the early days of the COVID pandemic. Here's Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank President Neel Kashkari on CNBC.
We've had a lot of people trying to figure out exactly why the Fed went 50 basis points last week. So maybe you can explain. If you are worried about the labor market at this point, is this the equivalent of saying mission accomplished when it comes to inflation?
Well, I think all of us are reluctant to ever declare mission accomplished, but certainly the risks have shifted. I look forward and I think, which risk am I more worried about right now? A surprising uptick in inflation or a surprising uptick in unemployment? It's the latter, at least it is for me. I think right now we still have a strong, healthy labor market, but I want to keep it a strong, healthy labor market. And a lot of the recent inflation data is coming in looking very positive that we're on our way back to 2%. So I don't think you're going to find anybody at the Federal Reserve who declares mission accomplished, but we are paying attention to what risks are most likely to materialize in the near future.
That makes a lot of sense, but it also makes a lot of sense for why you would have cut 25 basis points. Why go 50?
Well, I think it's a judgment call. Ultimately, even I said, you know, I've been on the more hawkish end of the committee over the last couple of years. Even I say after 50 basis points, I still think the policy is in a net tight position. At some point, we're going to be coming to the question of, are we at around neutral? There's a lot of ambiguity around neutral. I write about that in my essay. Other people comment on it. And at some point, we're going to have to debate, are we getting there? I think after 50 basis points, we're still in a net tight position. So I was comfortable taking a larger first step. And then as we go forward, I expect on balance, we will probably take smaller steps unless the data changes materially.
And on CNBC.com, writing today that Wednesday's rate cut, quote, signaled that the Fed is on its way to normalizing rates and bringing them back to a neutral position that neither pushes nor restricts growth. Campaign 2024 coverage now. We've heard a lot about the importance of the state of Pennsylvania to both campaigns. Well, that's where Democratic vice presidential nominee Governor Tim Walz was on Saturday, specifically in Bethlehem.
You could have been anywhere. You've got kids at soccer practice. You're ready for football. You're doing things at home, and it's a day off. But not this crew. You chose to come here. And the reason is simple. You love this country. That's why you came. Kamala Harris understands that. She understands what it means to serve. From her first day as a prosecutor, a district attorney, and then attorney general of the state of California, and vice president of the United States, she has had one thing on her mind. She serves the people. She serves the people. Her job is to serve and protect those people, whether it was taking on predators and fraudsters trying to cheat people, or there was taking on transnational gangs and greedy corporate interests. She was there and never hesitated to work with anybody across the aisle to get things done for the American people. And you can see it in her leadership. You can see it in her leadership. She talks often about this, and I love it when she says it. A mark of leadership is not who you can push down, it's who you can lift up. And of all of the hard things she's done and the difficult decision for people, she's done what you all know and what you can feel in this room. Hard work can be good work. Democracy is a, as you heard Anthony say, is a precious privilege and gift that we need to protect. And you can do it with joy, optimism, grace, and happiness. You can do it. I'm proud to be a part of this fight with her. I am proud. She oftentimes talks about it. Look, Tim and I grew up geographically a long ways apart, from Oakland, California, to small towns in rural Nebraska. I grew up in a town. Now, this is when you come from a small town, you heard John Mellencamp's music playing. You out small town people. I had 24 kids in my graduating class. 12 were cousins. But what you learn is your community is your family. You take care of one another. You look out for them. You lift them up. Kamala Harris says that. We didn't grow up in the same place, but we grew up around the same people. people who worked hard for a living, people who understand how to pay their bills and wanted to see their children get ahead, understood, as Anthony always talks about, the power of a teacher in public education to make a difference.
And you heard Governor Walz mention Anthony. That's actor Anthony Ramos, best known for his work in the Heights and Hamilton. He also appeared at the event. Meanwhile, former President Trump was in Smithton today, which is southeast of Pittsburgh. He held a roundtable discussion on his Protecting America initiative.
Can you tell the story of your daughter?
Yes, I'm sorry. The last thing I wanted to say is my hardest job is not running three businesses. It's actually being a mom to a daughter that is here with me today, Caroline Ray. She's 16 years old. I'm right there. Would you just raise your hand, honey, so that Mr. President can see? She's right there. She is not in school today, and she asked that she could be here and she could see you. I'm doing everything that I can to try to give her the truth every day. And I just wanted to say, and I told you that 8 years ago when you were running, and she was just 8 years old then, every night she would go to bed and I would kneel on the floor next to her bed and we would pray every single night for you. And every night she would speak out to God and she would say, "Dear God, please let Mr. Trump win, please." Mm. And the night of the election, of course, she had to go to bed early because she was in school. But at 2 o'clock in the morning, when we finally knew that you had won, I went into her bedroom. I scooped her up out of her sound sleep, and I was literally tears pouring down. And I said, "Baby, Mr. Trump won, baby. He won. He won." And she said, "Thank you, God. Thank you, God." And so she is here with us today. And I just wanted to let you know that we are still praying for you.
Thank you very much. Well, it's almost more important today. When you add the border, where we have millions of people coming in and from prisons and from mental institutions and terrorists and traffickers, human traffickers, drug traffickers, I believe it's more important today. We had a bad border then, and I fixed it, totally fixed it. In fact, it wasn't even a subject at the next election, but we totally fixed it. But that border was nothing compared to what's happened now. This border is so bad and so dangerous for our country. I think it's more important today. I think it's going to be the most important election in the history of our country. Thank you very much. And thank you, beautiful daughter. Thank you very much. Very nice story. Thank you.
You can find all of our campaign 2024 coverage at cspan.org/campaign. And more now on that note, left by Ryan Wesley Routh, the man suspected of attempting to assassinate former President Trump. According to the Washington Post, prosecutors said Mr. Routh had been in Florida for at least 30 days before the attack. And Politico writing today that he, quote, left a note several months ago urging others to finish the job and offering $150,000 to anyone who managed to kill the Republican presidential candidate. Politico goes on to write, quote, prosecutors said suspect Ryan Routh placed the chilling handwritten letter in a box containing tools and building materials left at the home of an unnamed associate. Addressed to the world, the message denigrated Trump's moral character and faulted him for his policy toward Iran. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, there are roughly 580,000 active DACA recipients in the U.S. as of the end of 2022. Of course, DACA stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It is the status given to some undocumented immigrants who arrived in the U.S. as children. It allows them to avoid deportation, work legally, and get a Social Security number and driver's license. The majority of DACA recipients are under age 36, according to KFF, and over half are female. Well, today here in Washington, Elizabeth Vaquera, director of the George Washington University Hispanic Leadership Institute, spoke about the impact of Trump administration-era immigration policies on DACA recipients.
Could you talk a little bit about the specific effects of the Trump administration policies on immigrants and their families?
I could talk for the next 2 hours to all of you, but I'll spare you from that. I'm glad that you're asking that question, because I was writing a note as I was writing. I was listening to Ernesto, thinking exactly what you're saying. It's like, we are in an election year. Why the border is like presenting all these crises? The border is very visual. People can identify a place, can identify some people, can identify what's happening, right? So it's such an excellent political tool for people to be scared, for people to be hopeful, for people to think that the government is doing enough or not doing enough. So there you have it. I would like to focus a little bit on how what we know, right? If we think of the policies of how they're going to work, they're going to affect families, they're going to affect immigrants. We know what we've done in the past. So that's what I've been studying, particularly the rhetoric and the hatred, the language that some of our politicians have used in the past. And I can tell you from what I've investigated and the work that I've been doing, particularly during the Trump administration, it wasn't just the policies in themselves that they did damage, but the fear of the rhetoric, the fear of some policies being implemented, even if they were not going to be implemented, that caused harm. So we need to take that into consideration when we are thinking about immigrants, when we are thinking about what we are saying, how we are representing, what language are we using. Many times we don't talk about them, and, you know, we're like poisoning the blood of the country, like as being infested, being the, you know, like the virus of something, right? So what language we use dehumanizes what immigrants are, and much of my work has been about that. It's like, we're talking about not just about numbers. We're talking about humans. We're talking about families. We're talking about individuals. So I can tell you a little bit about the work that I've been doing on DACA, for example. We know DACA was a welcome change, like a, you know, executive action, something better than nothing, totally insufficient at the same time. We know that doesn't solve, it solves some problems, but doesn't solve many problems. That it's has to be renewed every 2 years, doesn't have a path for citizenships. We know that has had adverse effects on how people can make decisions for themselves. It made progress. It helped people finding jobs, thinking of themselves as like more participants of, it opened doors for DACA recipients to be participants in the US. But then the rescission came in 2017, right? I mean, it was rescinded. And what we've seen, in just in my sample, 1 in 5 tried to die by suicide when the rescission came of DACA. That's a high number, right? That, you know, like when your rights are taken away, that you started, you know, maybe taking for granted or being participating in society. Many, many of the DACA recipients that, you know, when the rescission came, they had to change their plans. Of like, well, now I wanted to study, but maybe I should work because I don't know if I'm going to be able to work in 2 months, so I'm not going to continue my studies. And these are people that have lived here. We, as a country in cities where these individuals live, we get harmed by these people having to change their plans, right? So I would like, you know, I could say a lot more about this, but, you know, one thing to say is that our immigration policies do not only harm immigrants, they also harm the communities in which they live. And immigrants do not live, as I said earlier, in a vacuum. They are married to citizens. They have children who are citizens. They have neighbors who are citizens. They give the food to citizens. So just to say that, you know, our policies have the chance to open doors, open opportunities, open careers, but also, like we saw with the rescission of DACA, harm lives and change career paths.
Elizabeth Vaquera, director of George Washington University's Hispanic Leadership Institute, earlier today at an event co-hosted by the Wilson Center. You can see the entire event at cspan.org. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is in the U.S. this week. Yesterday, he was in Scranton, Pennsylvania, visiting a munitions factory that's been involved in supplying the Ukrainian war effort. And last night, he received the American Academy of Achievements Golden Plate Award.
None of us would wish, no matter where in America, Ukraine, or anywhere across Europe, anywhere in the world, no one willingly chooses regimes like the Russian one, Iranian, or any other dictatorship for their children. These regimes are always built on violence, always make wars and spill blood, and always steal the future. They ruin years, leaving decades in ruins. This is why they must lose. And we don't have much time. The next few months will be decisive. Ahead of us in this war, Russia's war against Ukraine, and all of you, because this is Russia's war against freedom itself. We are short of time to define what the outcome will be. And we must define it, not Russia, not their bloody allies. We need to be faster. We need not to lose the next few months in war so that we don't lose next decades. Ukraine has a plan of victory. And I will present this plan to America, first of all to President Biden, to the Congress, and to both presidential candidates, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, and all our global allies. And I believe this must be our shared achievement, victory for freedom, with no compromises at freedom's expense. Right now, we all hold the power to shape the world our children and their children will live in. What will they believe in, our children? Will they believe in the values that unite all of you despite any differences and this country and our bond with America? Or will they lose hope living in a world where wars are permanent? This golden plate will never be given to Putin or such as him. The reason is obvious. There are no awards for killings they bring, for dreams they ruin, and for countries they burn.
According to the American Academy of Achievements website, the Golden Plate Award is given to, quote, men and women of exceptional accomplishment in the sciences, the professions, business, industry, arts, literature, sports, entertainment, and public service. They are acclaimed not as winners, but as visionaries and achievers who represent the many who excel. President Zelensky is scheduled to head here to Washington to present to members of Congress and the Harris and Trump campaigns what he's calling a plan for victory against the Russian invasion. His visit comes as the White House prepares a new $375 million military aid package for Ukraine. President Zelensky is then expected to head to New York for a UN Security Council meeting. That's tomorrow. And then a speech at the General Assembly on Wednesday. A reminder, you can get Washington Today as a podcast and listen to it on demand. You can find it at cspan.org/podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. You can also find it on YouTube. Just search Washington Today. And for more on the stories that are shaping Washington every day, get our daily email, word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Gary Sterkoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.